welcome to the Mariner's Library with me, Chris Stanmore Major. And in this episode, we're continuing the story, The Search for Captain Slocum by Walter Magnus Teller. We're on the 18th chapter, and this is the 14th part of the reading. And if you haven't already, please consider going over to patreon.com/themariner to help support the podcast. Or you can check out the Mariner podcast with all things sailing and seamanship each week. Or, of course, the Mariner YouTube channel, where you can see gear reviews, how-to videos, and me engaged in expeditions and projects all over the world. Now on with the story. Chapter 18. To young men contemplating a voyage, I would say, go. Slocum was not unreconciled to this world, but he travelled unimpeded by any great sense of that social virtue, resignation. For years he had managed the divided life quite well, involvement and escape, acquisitiveness and simplicity. In December 1899 he went home, alone, to Westport on Briar Island. There in the village where he had got the little schooling he had and his jumping-off place 40 years before, he read the proofs of his forthcoming book. A couple of old schoolmates went up to Yarmouth to hear him lecture. In February 1900 he rejoined his relations in East Boston, but in March he went east again. Indeed, at no time for the rest of his life was he able to stand still for long. He was not only restless but bitter because of the criticism he received at the hands of his wife's relations. He thought that others of his cousins might feel the same way. He was also dissatisfied at not getting what he considered sufficient returns on his talks. It irked him not to be as independent as his nature demanded. He was capable of letting his irascible side show up if provocation was given or even suspected. One could not hide anything from a mind like his, and small slights would rankle and never be forgotten or forgiven, a sympathetic relative wrote. On the 24th of March 1900, Sailing Alone Around the World was published in book form by the Century Company. They and successor companies kept it in print till 22nd of June 1948. All told, there were 17 printings, of which Slocum saw 5. On the 6th of September 1951, rights in the book was released to the estate of Joshua Slocum and subsequently assigned to Sheridan House Incorporated. The latter, in 1954, reissued the book. In 1956, Grosset and Dunlap reprinted from the same plates. Author's note, later printings were horribly scrimped as to stock, margins and binding. Copies of the first edition have been quoted as high as 10 times the original price. A breakdown of the 17 printings shows a small but steady demand. Between 1900 and 1948, 27,474 copies of the regular edition were sold, plus 16,200 copies of lower-priced Blue Ribbon Books Incorporated reprints. The early printings were bound in navy blue cloth with an anchor and seahorse stamped on the cover. There were 294 pages on heavy stock, gilded on the top. The price was $2. Like the serialization, it was illustrated, using most of the same illustrations, by Thomas Fogarty and George Varian, two of the leading illustrators of the day. Their work, like Slocum's, was one in the trial by time. It continues to evoke that flavour one thinks of as turn of the century. Fogarty, who made most of the drawings, was a true artist. His sketches of places he had never been, of actions he had never seen, are affecting. There is a mildness in the expression of his dream which invites the reader to dream a dream too. The Century Company went to work promoting Sailing Alone. They issued a nice 4-page illustrated flyer in which reviews from various papers were quoted. First place was given to the comment of Sir Edwin Arnold, poet and journalist. He said of the captain's story, "The most extraordinary book in its way ever published. The adventure itself is by far the most courageous, sustained and successful enterprise of the kind ever undertaken by mortal man." Slocum went to work too. He got up his own 1-page broadside. He quoted from friendly reviews from far-off places, Sydney and Natal, and he published a testimonial letter, a word from American shipmasters of the highest standing. But he gave top billing to Mabel. She said, "Round the world alone, a mighty motto this, and in all the world's history it applies to only one man, Captain Joshua Slocum. Amid solitude and silence, with the keel of his little boat he has traced the great circle, the emblem of eternity. The captain's frequent protestations of modesty reflect the constant struggle to control an opposite feeling. By the magic of pen and paper, he succeeded admirably in sailing alone, in giving permanent form to the modest and soft-spoken man that he only sometimes was. A book is the place to romanticize oneself, letters the place to let oneself go. In this first written comment on his book, he wrote Boole, "It is as you say, your artist has made a fine-looking man appear to the gaze of all who turn over the pages of Sailing Alone to the End. But for all his good looks, the skipper of the Spray, like his accomplished editors, prides himself more on winning ways. The Spray herself appears in the frontispiece. One feels, while looking at her, that one might step aboard there and sail on." All in all, Slocum reacted as most authors do. At first, relief and pleasure and self-infatuation as the manuscript goes to the printer. Then the book appears. It seems a bit of a failure, never quite fulfilling the hope. And finally, the realization of the permanence of print overwhelms all other feelings. Also, according to conventional author behavior, he began to worry about what the papers would say. He wrote Boole, "I expect I'll get fits if the transcript goes for me, but the man who gave me the note to the editor has marked the little work in his window the best sea story ever written. So much for Boston." A friend introduced me to the editor of the Herald today, who had lots of good things to say about the magazine articles, but, as far as I know, had not said them beyond his own sanctum. Many think that I will get a full house on Monday. I'll give Bostonians beans if I don't. I'll give them beans anyhow if I can. Enclosed, please find a couple of tickets to my show, Monday the 23rd. Author's note: the show was a sea talk at Tremont Temple, Boston, 23rd of April, 1900, 8 p.m. It was advertised as illustrated with stereopticon views. Tickets sold from 25 cents to $1. The following day, the Boston Herald reported an audience of several hundred people. A cousin, Mrs. Fanny I. McLean of Reading, Massachusetts, recalling the captain on that evening, wrote the present writer, "He was in full evening clothes, was very much at ease, and very witty." 2 weeks later, Slocum continued. He was obviously still worrying. "I have heard nothing from the critics about my fine writing, and hope to hear nothing. If they'll only pass me this time, I'll steer clear of like shallows in the future. I beg that the changes may be made in the plates, especially on page 12. While I do not pose as a professional writer, I should not leave a libel on the American shipmaster. I was considerably interested in the story at the time of telling it and didn't see the enormous sunken ledges that I see now. I have not gone critically over this Child of the Sea, but after a cooling off, I see at a glance many improvements which I shall be able to make in the text, a touch here and there. Doing so would be no more than the great author of Ivanhoe did. I wonder if another edition will be wanted wherein I may somewhat retrieve." But there was no need for concern. He had done his work well. The reviews were good, a few of them as uninspired as that in the New York Times. The Times reviewer called the book full of interest to lovers of adventure. The Nautical Gazette said of Slocum, "His voyage was interesting. His book is better." Sailing Alone was described as a book of travel by sea that is well nigh perfect of its kind, the work of an artistic and therefore a master hand. The reviewer for the New York Mail and Express found a second reading even more entertaining than the first, for it revealed many touches overlooked and gave more opportunity to admire the way in which the story is told as well as the story itself. The Nation and the New York Evening Post employed the same reviewer and used the same review. Absence of literary finish and florid word painting sinks into insignificance compared with the overwhelming impression his story conveys of dominant courage and placid self-reliance. With all the attention that was lavished upon him, his sense of humor was not diminished. The reviewer proposed Slocum for the Hall of Fame, which was about to be established. The notice in The Nation was read in London by R.B. Marston of Samson Low, Marston & Company. He obtained the book and wrote Slocum, "I was laid up at home under orders not to read, but I began your book after breakfast and sailed the whole of the 40,000 and odd miles with you before night and wished for another 40,000. We are Jules Verne's English publishers, and your fact is stranger than his fiction." Sampson, Lowe, Marston and Company published Sailing Alone in the summer of 1900. Sir Edwin Arnold reviewed it in the Daily Telegraph, 8th of September. No one knowing the sea and following Captain Slocum's narrative would tolerate any snigger of suspicion, with which ignorant persons oft-times accost great deeds. The tale is true from first to last, written in a style plain as a marlinspike, and yet full of touches which show what hidden poetry and passionate love of nature were in the soul of this blue-nose skipper. Slocum's book is one of those minor classics which gain poignancy and meaning with the passing of time. More than 50 years after its first appearance, it is read by the general reader as a story of resolute adventure and travel, by the amateur sailor as scripture. Written in simple, straightforward, felicitous language, it has worn like pure gold. But there are also qualities in it not readily apparent to earlier generations of readers. In mid-20th century, it speaks of spontaneity and the feeling for space, for some way out of a rapidly contracting world. In writing the story of the voyage, Slocum also wrote the story of who he was and how he survived. Though he naturally had to suppress a great deal, for that was the Stoic and shipwreck tradition, though self-revelation would have seemed to him weak and even contemptible, he nevertheless wrote a self-revealing book. The goal of individual accomplishment and personal distinction is clear. His book is both product and record of the struggle not to disappoint himself, and also the transcendence of the struggle. Beneath the outwardly conventional, simple-hearted manner, there emerges something other than a simple-hearted book. Stories of bolters and solitaries are seldom as simple as they seem. Only a mystic could have sailed as Slocum did. Only a Yankee trader could have understated the matter so eloquently. By keeping the action always in focus and not reaching out to the effects of the action, Slocum concealed from his contemporaries the inner form of his book. As a lecturer, he had found, so he wrote in a letter, that people wanted to laugh, not cry. However, at this remove, it suggests itself clearly enough. The hidden cry is in the very words of the title. All this humorous nonchalance, his austere matter-of-factness, no longer disguise the repression of his longing for contact and for the warmer feelings of life. He loved his calling, and he wrote of it with love. While Slocum sailed onward, he also moved inward. Thus his book corresponds to an ever-recurring mood, and he himself speaks to an ever-recurring condition. Though his birth in maritime history is as certain as Noah's, he has, as yet, no place in the history of American literature. None of the standard reference works on literature includes him. Among critics, only Van Wyck Brooks has written his appreciation of him. J. Duncan Spaeth, who for many years taught American literature at Princeton, was so struck by Slocum's literary style that he went to see the Captain and the Spray at Gloucester sometime around 1900. Spaeth wrote, "I remember seeing an edition of Hakluyt's Voyages, well-worn and evidently well-read, on whose style Slocum's own was modelled." Spaeth included the Captain in a recommended reading list. It is, however, very doubtful that Slocum used Hakluyt or anyone else as a model. If he did, he himself was not aware of it. When asked how he had acquired his style, he replied, "I was not aware that I had any particular style. I certainly never studied to possess one." Understandably, the style, like the experience, was a singular one. Slocum had no literary theories. Unschooled and shrewd and naive, a provincial world traveller, he stood apart from prevailing literary fashions. A master of sail, spiritually displaced and isolated in his own time, he was in fact a kind of primitive writer. Sailor, peddler, indefatigable teller of tales, Slocum seems the very embodiment of the legendary Yankee, going his own way and improvising as he goes, doing his own bargaining, making his own calculations, and always alone. In a sense, writing about the sea was only incidental to his Yankee predilection for writing about himself. Constance Rourke, in her suggestive study of the national character, pointed out that the persistent form of Thoreau's writing was the monologue. She might have added that it was Slocum's too, unrehearsed, spare, natural in lingo, personal in flavour. Starting not from Palmanock but from North Mountain, Slocum might have been one of the mythical Americans of whom Whitman sang. a Yankee bound my own way, ready for trade, my joints the limberest joints on earth and the sternest joints on earth. He was a veritable apparition of the type that had become symbolic. Around 1900, at Lagoon Heights, Martha's Vineyard, he was seen at a clam bake and shore supper with brothers, sisters, in-laws, and a handful of summer people. He was above the middle height, one of the latter recalled, wiry-looking, brown beard, blue eyes. With a little makeup work, he would have been a ringer for Uncle Sam. And the young, at the time, summer resident remembered the typical Yankee mask of suppressed emotion. Although the captain was a good mixer, he wrote 50 years later, he also seemed like an extreme introvert. There is another element in Slocum's writing, and which also has to do with his early environment and its popular and oral tradition. In the middle of the 19th century, a good deal of 17th century English still was spoken by the everyday people of English-Scotch descent in rural Nova Scotia. King James English was a built-in feature of Slocum's language, and it did not come from much reading of the authorised version. Indeed, he never spoke of reading the Bible, and there is no indication that he had a copy on the spray. Garfield wrote that his father sailed without one. Earlier in his career, when as captain of the Northern Light, and then the Aquidneck, certain of his duties required a Bible, he had borrowed Virginia's. Slocum was a deeply religious man, but the harshness and narrowness of the religion he saw in his childhood turned him forever against creed, and whatever he thought smacked of cant. Slocum was a man of his own kind, and he had his own way of expressing his adoration of the work of the hand of the Creator. In 1903, Charles Scribner's Sons published an abridgment of Sailing Alone. It was called, as once every schoolboy might have known, Around the World in the Sloop Spray, a geographical reader describing Captain Slocum's voyage around the world by Captain Joshua Slocum. In a preface to the excised version, Slocum characteristically almost tells how it happened. It was my good fortune a short time ago to be invited to the School of Pedagogy in New York to meet Dr. Edward R. Shaw. Dr. Shaw was in the midst of a lecture when I entered the room. From this, he turned to Sailing Alone Around the World, which, to my surprise and delight, he quoted off the reel. Here I met a large-hearted man at the right moment. He read my mind, or how else could he perceive my desire to see the story of the Spray's voyage still more useful? With the leave of your publishers, said Dr. Shaw, I will make the story of the Spray's voyage adaptable to school uses. Then we shall have a story of adventure and a lesson in geography all in one. In launching the new literary packet, I desire to commend it especially to the indulgence of children around and all over the world. Professor Shaw, Dean of the School of Pedagogy at New York University, had read Condensed for School Reading with Suggestions for Correlation 2 years before The Mast and Robinson Crusoe. He recognized that Sailing Alone belonged with narrative writing of that high order, and also that, like Dana's book and Defoe's, Slocum's could be read as a boy's book. It can be, if one wants to ignore what it is really about. What Professor Shaw, in his contemporary wisdom, could not see was that 20th century readers would find the saga of the middle-aged ex-merchantman considerably more interesting psychologically than Dana's youthful adventure, and almost as haunting and satisfying as the creation of Defoe. Though well-intentioned and a wonderfully agreeable method for learning geography, the abridgment was a piece of American downgrading. It is as inferior to the original as its title to the true title. Even so, it reads tolerably well. Many people reading it thought they were getting Sailing Alone. That was partially the captain's fault. He got hold of copies and sold them without explaining the difference. He was not the man to let literary considerations interfere with commerce and trade. Well, that's all for today. I hope you're enjoying the story so far. The next installment will be available in the Mariner's Library shortly. And remember, of course, you've got all the content over on YouTube and the Mariner podcast, and of course, Patreon at patreon.com/themariner. But for now, wherever you are and whatever you're doing, I hope that you're safe and sound, and I look forward to speaking to you in the next one. Cheers.